Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. A quarter century ago, the case of Nancy Cruzan focused the nation on the question of defining life and death in physiological, legal, and ethical terms. Our guest this week, William Colby, has just published a book on the case, and he'll be joining us to place it into the historical context of our struggle with this challenging and often perplexing issue. And after that, Charles Richard will give us some history on our learning to dance with the French. But before we get to those subjects, Joey Skidmore takes us back once again to an event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on September 2, 1945, Japan formally surrendered to the Allies aboard the USS Missouri, which lay anchored in Tokyo Bay. It was a bloody and costly war brought to a conclusion by the dropping of two atomic bombs. On August 6, 1945, the U.S. bomber Enola Gay dropped an atomic bomb on the Japanese city of Hiroshima, killing an estimated 80,000 people. On August 9, when no surrender came, President Truman ordered another atomic bombing on the city of Nagasaki, where over 76,000 people died. That same day, Japan initiated peace talks, and 3 days later accepted Allied terms of surrender.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, the economics of classical music may be in the pits, so to speak, but auction prices of composers' manuscripts are soaring. Continuing that trend, the final manuscript of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony recently sold at Sotheby's in London to an anonymous buyer for nearly $3.5 million, the second highest musical manuscript sale ever. And the Russians are rewriting their history again. This time, the Mongols are okay. The old saying that Russia is the only nation with an unpredictable past appears to be truer than ever as Russian scholars try to recast Moscow's view of the medieval Tatars. The Tatars, for whom the Republic of Tatarstan is named, trace their lineage to a branch of Genghis Khan's vast Mongol army that swept across most of Asia and subjugated Russia in the 13th century. Traditionally, Russian historians have taken the position that nearly 2.5 centuries that the country spent under Tatar-Mongol rule was a catastrophe, that the invaders held Russia in barbarism at a time when much of Europe was edging into the modern age. The goal of revisionist historians is to replace the prevailing image with the idea that the Tatars were one of the formative sources in Russian history. And this is no dry academic dispute. Modern Tatarstan, one of Russia's most populous and oil-rich republics, declared limited sovereignty a decade ago and has been searching for an identity which will either draw them back into the Russian state or drive them further away. History may provide that identity if they get it right this time. This is Talking History. Death will always be with us. But as final as it seems, defining death is not always easy to do, as witnessed by the case of Nancy Cruzan. William Colby has written a book on Cruzan's death and the issues it raised. He speaks with Drew Burgesson, professor of history at the University of Missouri, Kansas City.
Death has always been a part of human history, but in recent decades, the boundary between life and death is blurred in physiological, legal, and ethical terms. Today, I have the pleasure of trying to reconstruct that history in part with William H. Colby, a fellow of the Midwest Bioethics Center in Kansas City and the advocate for the family of Nancy Cruzan in the first right-to-die case ever heard by the United States Supreme Court. His book, Long Goodbye, The Deaths of Nancy Cruzan, was published by Hay House in 2002. Bill, welcome to Talking History.
Thank you very much, Drew.
You have spoken in many venues about the Cruzan case from a legal and ethical standpoint. I wonder if you might explore the topic for our listeners from an historical perspective. Let's start with technology. When and how did medical science blur the boundary between life and death?
That's a big question, and we're on a show that's talking about history. So in terms of history, it's extremely recent. Just take people back to the 1960s. Many listeners will remember the Dr. Kildare show.
Right.
Dr. Kildare, when things got very dark, when it looked like there was no other option, would often say, "Go get me the bird." He was talking about something called a bird respirator, invented by a man named Forrest Bird in California in the late 50s, started to be used in the 60s. One of his respirators, early ones, didn't have an automatic switch. So a doctor or a nurse would have to sit with a machine and flip a switch 12 times a minute to shoot a blast of air into the body.
Huh.
Those patients on Dr. Kildare's show sometimes survived. In the real world, they often survived only a day or two, regained their ability to breathe on their own, or died.
Right.
So it's just been the 60s and the 70s when technology has advanced to the point that it's made these decisions now a matter of technology and not nature necessarily.
So it seems in your book that since the 1970s, you're arguing that we've literally seen the emergence of a new class of human beings, neither fully deceased nor fully living. How did this new class of patients challenge the practice of medicine?
Well, the technology has raised some fundamental questions about what the goal of medicine is, how we use technology, and when we say it's not serving the ends that we sought to have it serve.
Mm-hmm. How does this new class of patients challenge the law? You're a lawyer.
I am. But as you can tell from the book, the law certainly has no special wisdom in this area. And most judges I've talked with who have had to decide a right-to-die case have said they wished it would have landed somewhere other than their courtroom or their courthouse. One way that the law has dealt with the question is the whole issue of defining death. Many states passed new laws. Missouri's was in 1982, and that's reflective of many other states, defining death in a new way, the so-called now brain death, where the traditional way we thought of death, the heart and lung stopping,
right,
didn't always necessarily answer the questions when technology was involved. Many states passed living will laws. We've had the laws tried to keep up to deal with the ethical questions, but it's not the special province of the law by any stretch.
And there's also a question of which part of the brain is dead, because you could have one part of the brain not functioning and the other one not part functioning.
The upper or thinking part of the brain can go a much shorter time without oxygen, and it's damaged, as opposed to the lower part, the brain stem, basically. That's not exactly technically right, but for our purposes. So the brain stem, that part which controls our primitive reflexes, can go a long time without oxygen and survive. The thinking part of the brain can't.
So you could have a situation where someone gets in a car accident, for instance, and the upper part of their brain, the thinking part of their brain, does not get enough oxygen, dies in effect, but the rest of the brain gets resuscitated by medical intervention.
Which, that's exactly what happened in the Cruzan case.
Right. What are some of the political stakes in this debate?
Well, I think in many ways, both going back but certainly going forward, the stakes are huge.
Mm-hmm.
We have, depending on who you listen to, but Census Bureau says before too long we're going to have close to 80 million of us baby boomers, 65 years old and older, over 20% of the population. Those boomers are going to have available to them technologies that we can't even dream of today. God knows what the funding will be at that point. and the boomers are a group of people who have always demanded things. So and there'll be a huge voting block. The questions about how to use this technology, when to use it, we're just at the tip of the iceberg right now.
I'm a German historian, so I'd like to ask you a slightly off-topic question. Many scholars tend to trace the origins of the Holocaust to the Nazi policies of euthanizing the handicapped. Nazi eugenicists called them Lebensunwürdiges Leben, or life unworthy of life. Can you describe how the memory of Nazi euthanasia affects this debate?
Let me answer that a couple of different ways. The first, I think, looking at the modern question of, in Nancy Cruzan's situation, someone in a car accident stopping medical treatment when it has not served as a bridge to recovery, that decision to stop medical treatment that hasn't worked and the decision to administer a lethal dose to hasten death, which we hear talked about today as euthanasia, I think between those two situations, there's a huge chasm. I just find them as fundamentally different decisions on moral, ethical, legal, many, many grounds. But then step back from that to the time you're talking about when in Nazi Germany, people were secreted away from their homes under false pretenses and then euthanized or murdered, and not as the result of any kind of family decision, which we have involved in these cases today, but from the state acting, I find them as really very different questions. Although, as the, what's the cliche of history? Those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. So we need to be mindful of the value of life and valuing life, but I think it was a fundamentally different time.
Tell us a little bit more about Nancy Cruzan, kind of the details of her case.
People who have read Long Goodbye have said to me that one of the things that strikes them is the universality of the story, that it can happen anytime to anyone. Joe Cruzan often said life can turn on a dime, and as a parent, you think about that phone call in the night from the state trooper that many parents have gotten that changes everything forever for that family.
Right.
For the Cruzans, Nancy was in a single car accident. She was 25 at the time, thrown from the car. As we reconstructed the story later, she went a significant period of time. It was a deserted country road before anyone arrived. May have been as long as 30 minutes. By the time they arrived that night, again, it, just as you asked, everything that made her uniquely human was gone from her brain and was never coming back. Family didn't know any of that. Their hope faded over time. Their knowledge about the power of anoxia or lack of oxygen came over time. And they came to a point several years later when they realized they had two basic choices: leave their daughter in a state facility, unaware of the world around her, without hope of regaining that awareness. Doctor said she could live 30 years. One bad choice. The other bad choice, to seek removal of the only technology keeping her alive, a feeding tube, and have that hand in the death of their daughter. They really had no good choices left.
Right. And one of the key decisions, I remember the section in the book where you were describing the nurses who were very reluctant to pull the tube out because they felt that that was equivalent to what we were just discussing a moment ago about the Nazis, that was an overt act that was intervening in the body, and by taking some overt act to hurt someone, that was slipping over that fine line between allowing someone to die and actually taking that life.
It's something that's written a lot in the medical literature that doesn't translate, at least in my experience, directly to the practice, is that initially withholding and later withdrawing medical treatment should be the same ethical standard. In fact, you should be more willing to initially try a treatment than if it doesn't serve the purpose for which you put it in place. You've at least tried for recovery, then stop that.
Right,
treatment.
Because the alternative would be that then I would not want to try something because I would never be able to pull it out.
Exactly right. And the other side of that alternative is to say to the parents, 3 weeks after the accident, we don't think there's much chance of recovery, but there's maybe a slim one. But if you say yes to this surgery today to insert this tube into your daughter who's lost the natural ability to swallow, then you forever forfeit your right to undo that permission. That puts parents in a horrible conundrum, which you'd never want to.
I was particularly struck when I read your book by the way that the Cruzan family treated Nancy as if she was both dead and alive at the same time, as if she was almost in two different kinds of states at the same time.
One of the counselors for the family said at the time, they're faced with a situation where they go to visit her twice a week, 90 miles from their home. They know she has no awareness of the world around her. So that each week, two times, that grief is reopened all over again. They're not allowed closure. They're not allowed moving on. But their loved one's still there in some capacity too. So it's not only that the horrible thing of having a child in such a profound accident, but then the long period of time in that kind of limbo where you're exactly right. They came into the room, they talked with her all the while, knowing she had no idea that they were there.
Or like when they celebrated Christmas and they were celebrating with her on the one hand, and yet they knew that she wasn't there at the same time. What a strange circumstance. You lost your case in the Supreme Court. So how did you win for Nancy the right to die?
People have the perception of the Supreme Court, or any court really, that you hear a case and you get an answer one way or another. Often the reality is a little bit more complicated than that. U.S. Supreme Court has 9 justices. Each can write their own opinion. In our case, 5 of the 9 wrote separate rulings on the Cruzan case. New York Times headline the next day said something to the effect, Cruzan's or new constitutional right found by Supreme Court. St. Louis Post-Dispatch said court rules against Cruzans. There was something for everyone in there. The court did say for the first time that all of us, conscious, competent people, have a federal constitutional right to refuse medical treatment. But it allowed states to have procedures in place as to how that right is executed for people who could no longer speak. It did say that new evidence can surface, so you could have a second trial, perhaps. That's what happened in our case. As a result of all of the publicity, people had come forward, so we had a second trial with the new witnesses.
And in the second trial, the state of Missouri decided not to fight with the same vehemence, and the result was that you were able to get approval to remove the tube from Nancy.
In the second trial, we only had the lawyer appointed by the court opposing us, as opposed to the lawyer appointed by the court and the state. And the state said at the time, the attorney general said at the time, we now know what the standard is, therefore we, the state, will not be involved any longer.
What other kind of landmark cases have followed since then?
That's really the only case that the U.S. Supreme Court has dealt with. There have been other state court cases. These issues continue to come up. There was the Finn case in Virginia, the Wendland case in California. Going on right now, the Schiavo case in Florida. So the issues don't stop, and they won't.
So what kind of advice would you give to our listeners, regardless of their position on the issue of the right to die, to protect themselves and their family in this brave new world in which death and life are no longer self-evident categories?
I guess a couple of things. People hear about something called a living will all the time.
Right.
A living will is a document where I would say, if I'm in certain conditions, if I have Alzheimer's, I don't want, and then you list the treatments, respirator, feeding tube, whatever it might be. I think those documents have some value. To me, the much more useful document and something that's easy for people to execute is a document that says, name someone to decide if you can't. It's called a durable power of attorney for healthcare proxy. If I'm incapacitated, here's who decides. But that's just the start. Research is very clear that either of those documents by themselves are not enough. You then need to talk with that person you've given the power to about your views, about your values, so that when the time comes of making those hard decisions, they're empowered to act as an advocate on your behalf, because it's never black and white at that moment. It's always gray. There are always hard decisions, and you need someone who knows what you want and who can act on your behalf.
Yeah, in the Nancy Cruzan case, the case in the end rested on whether or not she had explicitly said to other people that she would not want to be in a persistent vegetative state.
Maybe in part it rested on that, but I don't know how important the law is in this area. People are born, people die every day. Decisions have to be made. And in the Cruzan case, I think to a great extent, it turned on what the case did was to raise the consciousness of the country, to get people talking about their views and values. It was in the news for so many years, and we had so much discussion within our state about the topic, that we finally came to the point as a state saying we should allow the family to make this decision.
Great. Thank you very much. My guest today has been William H. Colby, lawyer, bioethicist, and author. His book, Long Goodbye, The Deaths of Nancy Cruzan, published by Hay House in 2002, is not so much a story of lives lived, what historians would understand as a biography, but of death lived, a necrography.
This week we celebrate Labor Day and the workers that have built this nation. To mark the annual event, we've selected as our site of the week a virtual site where you can learn more about work in southern cotton mills a century ago. Here to tell you about that site is Talking History regular Kelly Schrum of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University.
Like a Family, the Making of a Southern Cotton Mill World. In one of a series of interviews conducted in the late 1970s with textile workers in southern mill towns, George Dyer talks about his parents' decision to leave their farm in the hopes of making a better living in the mills. Mac Duncan describes his first job in the mill cleaning looms for 20 cents an hour. Flossie Durham talks about her first day spinning at the age of 10. Eula McGill discusses workers' grievances, and Grover Hardin talks about Roosevelt and the 8-hour workday. The site is a companion to the book Like a Family, The Making of a Southern Cotton Mill World, that depicts life in the southern textile mill towns from the 1880s to the 1930s. It offers more than 60 audio clips drawn from hundreds of oral history interviews with descendants of mill hands and others involved in the history of the southern textile industry. The site models the book and is divided into three chronological sections. Life on the Land discusses the agricultural roots of the rural South, changes in farm labor after the Civil War, and economic factors that caused the South's transition from agriculture to millwork in the late 19th century. Mill Village and Factory describes work in the textile mills and life in the company mill towns. Work and Protest discusses labor protests of the 1920s, formation of unions in the mills, and the textile strike of 1934. Each section offers an introduction, 20 to 30 audio clips, and teaching ideas that could be developed further. Unfortunately, the oral histories are presented only in audio. Transcripts are not available. This site, however, is valuable for learning about rural southern life and labor history from Reconstruction through the 1930s. To locate this site, go to historymatters.gmu.edu. Type Cotton Mill World into the keyword search.
And finally, as promised, Charles Richard is here to tell us about how we have tried to learn to dance with the French. Our recent irritation with one another is not new, Richard suggests. Rather, Americans and the French have long found one another annoying.
This year, with anti-American protests in Paris and perfectly good French wine poured down the gutter in Peoria, we're finally free to admit the hard historical truth. Americans and French people can find each other really annoying. Presidents George Bush and Jacques Chirac of France are scheduled to join each other this December at a New Orleans gala to celebrate the bicentennial of the Louisiana Purchase of 1803. And although there's been no official cancellation of the event, nobody I know here in Louisiana is rushing to rent a tux. Allies since the American Revolution, there's no real ill will between France and the United States. It's more like the carping of a cranky old couple, married more years than either likes to remember. They just get on each other's nerves. And they always have, even 2 centuries ago. About a month after the Stars and Stripes were raised over New Orleans, the local militia was called to a ballroom on a report that some kind of trouble had erupted there. What they found was a good old-fashioned drunken brawl between the city's leading French and American citizens. As well-dressed officers and gentlemen wrestled on the floor, a handful of Americans stood on one side noisily singing Hail Columbia, while on the other the French fired back with a rousing rendition of Allons enfants de la patrie, and all because they couldn't agree on whether to dance in the American style or the French. Many in the United States felt that Louisiana's native French, called Creoles, were too decadent and impractical ever to become good Americans. And Creoles found their new countrymen crude, reckless, and dangerously ambitious. Sort of how the French presently regard certain Texans. Thomas Jefferson appointed William C.C. Claiborne to govern the Purchase Territory. Normally a reserved, tightly buttoned gentleman, even Claiborne found that Louisiana's French infuriating. To bring these folks to their senses, he wrote, we'll have to aim cannons at them and knock down the walls of their city from top to bottom. Now, flummoxed as he was by the French Creoles, Claiborne managed to keep his cannons quiet. With prudent humility, the governor learned to loosen his collar a little, to compromise, and to speak French. He worked hard to court the favor of his skeptical citizenry. Meanwhile, he also courted a Creole bride. Eventually, Claiborne won the hearts of both. He married into the prominent New Orleans family of Clarice Durald, and the Creoles finally embraced Claiborne, making him their first democratically chosen governor. The French and the Americans undoubtedly will remain closely wed, no matter how irksome the old couple might find each other at times. Still, Presidents Bush and Chirac could do much to restore confidence in that relationship by putting aside their pride and coming to the big anniversary in New Orleans later this year and renewing their vows.
You've been listening to Charles Richard, who wrote the 6-hour documentary series Louisiana, A History, that will premiere on public television this fall. His commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. As always, we welcome your comments on this program or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, Joey Skidmore, producer, Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. Our site of the week was produced by Amanda Schumann of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University. To learn more about Talking History, visit our website at oah.org. You can find more information on the Center for History and New Media at historymatters.gmu.edu. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.
Maybe the choice of the streets that deserves that upon a platform to choose. But had it to lose. Not a ghost bloody country all covered with snow.